Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It is Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we got the Monday morning movie reviews, which is coming up very, very quickly. Also, we are going to talk about the Toy Hall of Fame finalists have been announced, and we're going to talk about some of the greatest toys of all time and much more. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. But we got to get into the movie reviews. Every Monday morning, Steve Procopi and Eric Childress join me for the movie reviews, and Eric sticks around. We talk box office as well. So let's get the guys on. Here's Eric. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
And Steve. Hey, Steve.
Good morning.
Good morning, everyone. How's everybody doing?
Good.
All right.
Awake.
All right. Let's see. Let's start with Steve. Why don't you tell us about The Mountain?
Oh, gladly. This is the latest from director Rick Alverson, who did a couple of movies recently called Entertainment and the Comedy that were, to put it mildly, challenging and perhaps even challenged. On The Mountain, this is definitely something much more accessible, if not necessarily more agreeable. This time he's sort of taking a look at the chilling American Gothic madness of the 1950s. It starts out with this kid named Andy, who's played by Ty Sheridan, who most people know from the X-Men movies, but last year he was also in Ready Player One. And his father dies. Father's played by Udo Kier. His father dies, and he's sort of taken under the wing of this doctor. Dr. Wallace finds, and I put doctor in quotes because he's self-taught, but he's also played by Jeff Goldblum, who is playing things pretty low-key for Jeff Goldblum, or for anybody really, but especially Jeff Goldblum. And he basically brings him on board, and they travel together, performing and documenting lobotomies. They go from asylum to asylum, basically taking care of these patients. And it's not like lobotomies like you might have today, although I don't even know if that's still a practice anymore. But it's basically the ice pick and the hammer and the corner of the eye thing. And like I said, he's self-taught, so he knows how to do this, but not much else when it comes to patient care. So anyway, they travel the country going from asylum to asylum, and Andy is taking pictures, basically. But it sort of veers into this weird sort of sneaky eroticism, it's sort of a surreal road movie, and Andy sort of goes to this coming-of-age thing when he meets this potential patient named Susan, whose father is played by Denis Levant, the French actor from Holy Motors, who is about as insane as you can possibly imagine in this film, because the guy is basically an orangutan in a human suit. But anyway, it's just like the movie kind of, as it goes, it gets progressively more uncomfortable and crazier. And whereas Alverson's other films sort of dare us not to walk out on them, and for some people, I think, there's sort of a beautiful, icy quality to this film that's very inviting and a little discomforting. Sheridan is particularly good, even though he doesn't really talk that much in the film, but he sort of knows how to glare at someone silently, observing them, judging them. He can kind of go from harmless to dangerous with very little adjustment or dialogue. And like I said before, Goldblum is remarkable here, playing very much against type, and it takes you a little to the point where it sort of takes you a little while to realize what a monster this guy is. In addition to being sort of a shocking look at the state of medicine in the 1950s, it's also a fairly bleak portrait of America. There's sort of the nation seems sort of frozen in time, and it seems like this attraction that Andy has to Susan is maybe the only thing that's going to thaw at least Andy's mind, if he doesn't go in the other direction and just completely lose his mind by being exposed to all this insanity. You know, having these two guys as lead actors in The Mountain, like I said before, makes it very accessible, maybe not commercially viable, but it's still pretty out there. It's sort of brutally grim, with an ending I don't think I could pass a test on, but it still feels right. And if you're in an experimental mood, I would say check it out. It's at the Gene Siskel Film Center.
I like his other two movies.
Yeah, well, some people do.
I do. I like both, particularly entertainment. And you know, Goldblum was doing press for this months ago.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I mean, it's been around for a while. I remember Goldblum doing like regular talk shows to talk about this movie, and I remember watching the interviews, going, "Wow, he's on Jimmy Fallon talking about this movie," which is just seems strange.
I think he's probably happy he's not just being brought in as like comic relief or something. This is like a legitimate part that he can really sink his teeth into, and he does a great job. I mean he's creepy as hell in this movie.
That's great. Well, he's a terrific actor. I think now that he's become like sort of a caricature, I think people forget what a great actor he is.
It's definitely a pleasant reminder for sure.
Okay, cool, that sounds good. That's The Mountain at the Siskel Center. All right, Eric, tell us about Where's My Roy Cohn.
Okay, well, if people who are not familiar with who Roy Cohn is, this documentary certainly gives you a pretty good stepping stone into this guy that is probably most known for being the assistant to Joseph McCarthy during the McCarthy hearings. What we learned more about this guy, we learn about exactly, you know, where he came from and how, as sort of one of the original dirty tricksters and a lawyer who would do just about anything conceivable, including, you know, breaking, bending, you know, destroying the law, as his means would follow. We discovered that, you know, he was doing this at a very early age. This is a guy that throughout many decades eventually got himself expanded into people that are players in today's modern political world. It's a documentary about, you know, people or other things that have been written and done about Roy Cohn. There was an HBO movie called Citizen Cohn with James Woods that I also recommend quite well. And this, you know, this is sort of a typical...
He was also, by the way, he was also a major character in Angels in America.
Angels in America, yes. I was going to mention that as well, that it was sort of the end of his life. He was a closeted homosexual, but he was very much sort of a self-hating. Any label you could possibly put on this guy, what he really was, he was a self-hating character. And, you know, this movie doesn't exactly get into the psychological aspects of that. It basically just tells you that this guy was just a real piece of work, a real evil guy that, you know, probably, you know, destroyed as much as he, you know, possibly could have created, you know, with his own happiness or you know, building up upon his own happiness. Whether or not this guy ever was happy or not kind of remains to be seen. But the title of the movie comes from what I think this movie really wanted to really kind of delve into, which is Roy Cohn's connection to our current president. Where's My Roy Cohn is essentially something that President Trump apparently had said at least once, maybe multiple times, in regards to Michael Cohen and, you know, people around him, you know, Jeff Sessions and his district attorney, people that were going to fight for him, fight tooth and nail for him, even though that's not what these people in government are supposed to be doing. They're supposed to be fighting for the people, not for the president of the United States. So that's where the title comes from, and you see the movie while giving us the entire background of this guy for the better part of an hour. It really is really kind of building up to what it wants to really do, is to connect him with Donald Trump and to show that, you know, a lot of the ills and things that we've been going through in this national nightmare that we have can be, you know, kind of contributed back to this guy's beginnings. It's no secret that Roger Stone is a major player in this film and is interviewed, and it's kind of interesting that this movie premiered at Sundance, although I missed it there and just recently saw it this week. But at Sundance, while this movie was playing, Roger Stone was arrested while we were out there. And now, you know, this movie is opening here in Chicago, and we're in the middle of this whole whistleblower scandal with Donald Trump. So,
Eric, hang on a second.
Okay.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll find out what Eric and Steve thought of the new documentary called Where's My Roy Cohn? And it's out right now. And we'll talk about that a little bit more after the news right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Skyline studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago on 720 WGN. And it is Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we're going to be talking about the Toy Hall of Fame has announced their finalists for this year. And we'll get into that. That's going to be a lot of fun. Joe Madden is out as Cubs manager. So we'll talk a little bit about Cubs managers of the past and a little bit remembering what was so fun about having Joe Madden as our manager for the Chicago Cubs. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You want to get in? You can also follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. It's Monday, which also means it's the Monday Morning Movie Review. Steve Procopi and Eric Childress join me every week to talk movies, and then we talk box office as well. Let's get Eric back in here. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
It's Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
Okay, Eric, continue. You're talking about the documentary, Where's My Roy Cohn?
Yeah, so what I was getting to is that, you know, this documentary certainly doesn't break any kind of new ground necessarily dramatically or, you know, aesthetically. You know, if you had told me this it was made by Alex Gibney, I would probably believe you, because it just feels exactly like all these documentaries of criminals and, you know, shady figures that we've been seeing for a number of years now. But, you know, that being said, you know, not many people probably know the history of this guy. And when they hear that name kind of bandied about in Trump circles, they, you know, just kind of get a kind of a rudimentary idea and might know a little bit about, you know, his connection with the McCarthy hearings, or maybe they saw Angels in America, but don't really quite grasp just what a ruthless scumbag this guy really was. So I think as a history lesson, the movie pretty much does its job. Even little bits in the story that I was not aware of. I didn't know he had such a friendship with Barbara Walters, for example. That really kind of blew my mind a bit. And the fact that she was actually a character witness for him when he was about to be disbarred, which really just kind of messed me up a bit. But yeah, as I said, it's nothing, you know, brand new, but it might be for some people, and I think those people would be interested in hearing a little bit more about how the past has potentially formed the present and maybe the future to come.
All right, Steve, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I did wonder at first when I heard about this film, like, why did they make a documentary about Roy Cohn today? And then the minute they hit the Trump stuff, you realize, you see the connection, and not just because Trump was a friend of his and he was his lawyer for a time, but these are sort of bullet point playbook things for Roy Cohn. Always attack, never admit blame or apologize, you know, favors and fear to ensure support, manipulate the media, lie shamelessly just to invalidate the idea of the truth and confuse the truth, weaponize lawsuits, don't pay taxes or bills. And most importantly, one of the things out of the Cohn playbook was inflame the prejudices of the masses by scapegoating defenseless people. And these all sound like very familiar and very relevant things. They often say that monsters aren't born, they're made. But I think this is a very good case for maybe one that was born. And it's fascinating. And if you can stomach it, it's a textbook profile of how not to live your life if you want to be a decent human being, because there was not an ounce of decency in this guy. He was a closeted, power-hungry, fame-hungry hypocrite. And I think the thing that got me the most, which I didn't realize about him, was that not only did he go after communists with McCarthy, but he went after gays in politics and really ruined a lot of careers that way, too, and which is shocking when you know, like, his story, that he, like I said, we said he's a closeted gay man. He got in trouble for that to a certain degree, but not enough to destroy him. And this is probably this is definitely a great way to examine someone like this in this sort of rearview mirror way. I'd rather do it that way than actually have to have them running the country necessarily. But yeah, I mean, it's an enraging documentary, especially when you start pulling all of these lessons into the present and all of the realizing all of the things that are fueling our current world. So Roy Cohn is very much alive and thriving today, and the movie's terrific.
Okay, and it's playing in at the River East downtown. And it's also playing at the Landmark Century on Clark and in Evanston at the Century in Evanston.
Yep.
Okay, cool. Where's my Roy Cohn? All right. Steve, why don't you tell us about Britt Marie was here?
Yes. So 3 years ago, there was this wonderful little Swedish film called A Man Called Uwe, and it was released in the U.S., and it, as far as art house films go, it found a really nice, sizable audience and was even nominated for 2 Oscars, including Best Foreign Language Film. The movie was based on a best-selling novel by someone named Frederick Backman, whose works have been very big in America for some reason, although I've got some on my bookshelf here. And now this adaptation of another one of his books, Britt Marie Was Here. The story concerns a 63-year-old woman named Britt Marie, played by Pernilla August. She is a woman to whom order and routine means everything, and she has kept her house spotless and tidy for the entirety of her 40-year marriage. But clearly her husband's apathy about her hard work has taken its toll on sort of the passion in their life. After her husband has a heart attack, she goes to the hospital and finds a younger woman there by his bedside. The mistress leaves, and Britt Marie doesn't really want to talk about it, but as soon as she gets home that night, she starts packing her stuff and leaves her husband. And she doesn't really have any prospects or marketable skills outside of housework. She takes a completely unsuitable job heading up a youth center in sort of a backwater Swedish town called Borg. Her primary task is to coach a rowdy bunch of kids into something that resembles a soccer team. And the previous coach has just died and was fairly loved. So what follows is a combination of sort of an elderly woman not only discovering that she still has something to offer the world at large, but she also starts to grow to love the freedom she has and that she experiences outside of her home. If this film had been made in America, I think the life lessons would have been a little bolder and maybe more obvious. But in the hands of this filmmaker named Tuva Novotny, who was an actress turned filmmaker, Britt Marie doesn't have to go through these sort of radical changes to make her less abrasive or less passive aggressive. In a way, the world and Britt Marie kind of meet in the middle. She doesn't have her own children of her own, so suddenly having to relate to all these kids around her is something of a shock to her system. And the kids they're not like the Bad News Bears, but the struggle is real but manageable. And the way she sort of slowly integrates herself into the town is actually really nice, too. It's not forced. She moves in with the daughter of the late soccer coach. There's like a town councilman who wants to sort of shut the place down after the last match, even though one of his kids is on the team. And there's also, of course, naturally a potential love interest in the form of a handsome police officer. Thankfully, that story doesn't really ever become the focus of the film, but it still gives Britt Marie hope that in that area of her life, especially when her husband shows up demanding that she come home and sort of put their home back in order because the guy's all heart. So, like I said, in this country, Pernilla August is probably best known for playing Anakin Skywalker's mother in the Star Wars prequels, but she has a really long, wonderful history of being like a preeminent actor, stretching back to like the 70s. She was in a bunch of later Ingmar Bergman films, and she never really hasn't stopped acting, although I haven't seen her in a while, and it's sort of wonderful to see her shine like this and bring her gifts as a performer capable of playing this sort of life in transition.
Okay, Steve,
yep,
hang on 1 second. We got a break here. Got a break. You guys hold on a second. We're going to take a break, and we'll come back, and Steve will tell us more about Britt Marie Was Here, which is a new movie. Movie reviews will continue right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here in downtown Chicago, here till 5 a.m., as we are every weekday morning. My dad's going to call in a little later and tell a joke. After 5 o'clock, you got the opening bell with Steve Grzanich. 6 o'clock, you've got Steve Cochran for your morning drive, and it is Monday morning. And we got the Monday morning movie reviews going. Before the break, Steve Procopi was telling us about a film called Britt Marie Was Here. Let's welcome the guys back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
Okay, Steve, continue. Britt Marie Was Here.
Just wrapping it up. So, like I said, Pernilla August is just so perfect for this sort of life and transition story. It's subtle, but it's not afraid to show the challenges of upending one's world late in life, emerging from the fear of the new, and finding friendships and new love. And it's a small, sweet work that finds notes of grace at times that elevate it into something that's almost inspirational. I really enjoyed it. So, and I think as far as I know, in the city, it's only playing at the Landmark out in Highland Park. So.
Okay, Landmark in Highland Park, if you want to see it. It's a Britt Marie Was Here. Okay, cool. All right, Eric, tell us about The Death of Dick Long.
Okay, this is a movie that premiered back at Sundance, and that was when I saw it, so my details are a little hazy, please forgive me. But it's a story of three friends who, at the beginning of the film, are finishing up their band practice and basically decide to have a bit of fun, as country boys are prone to do. Involves some fire, some shotguns, a lot of drinking, and then cut to what looks like the beginning of Reservoir Dogs, with one of the friends bleeding pretty profusely in the backseat of a car, as the two guys, less concerned with how they're going to fix him and just getting him to the hospital and trying to distance himself from any responsibility to what might have actually happened to him. So the two of them end up trying to anonymously drop him off at a hospital, sans ID, and try and drop him off as a John Doe, and then go about their daily lives. Well, poor Dick Long dies, and sets up two parallel storylines with people at the hospital, including the doctors and some local police, trying to figure out exactly what happened to this guy. And then the two friends trying to live out. One of the guys has a wife and daughter, and the other guy is probably far less responsible. Is trying to keep his distance as best he can, and the two of them just trying to how they're going to explain blood in their car and blood on their clothes and where they were all night, and Dick's wife or fiance, played by Jess Wexler, doesn't know where he is, and trying to ward off her suspicions about what may have happened. This is, despite the grim nature of what I just described, is actually supposed to be a comedy, and it was directed by one half of the Daniels. The Daniels, whose last film was the really terrific Swiss Army Man, and here have created another movie, at least one of them has, about a corpse and wackiness that ensues when trying to deal with it. And I remember watching the movie at Sundance and knowing it's supposed to be a comedy, and just not responding to it whatsoever, with the exception of, I think, maybe two times in the movie where I really kind of laughed quite heartily. The rest of the movie I just felt was just really flat. It's the direction of the sort of the Hicks that are at the front and center of this movie are just not particularly it was just not that clever in the way that they were trying. I mean, I know the movie, they're not supposed to be clever, quote unquote. They're actually supposed to be very incompetent and whatnot, but there's a cleverness sometimes to incompetency, and this movie for me just never really reached that level. Then even over in the cops and the doctor side, it felt very little of that worked at all. And so the movie just kind of dragged itself through just one kind of less interesting predicament to the next, not even really sort of expanding upon the urgency of the issue. Some people have told me that I'm wrong on this one. I remember at Sundance not laughing much at all and walking away just kind of shrugging my shoulders and like, I'd rather watch Swiss Army Man again.
Okay. Steve, what do you think?
It is a comedy, but it's so dark. that I don't think it's like your traditional laugh out loud thing. I found it very funny, and I think I more admired the film than liked it flat out. But, you know, Eric mentioned their incompetence. Their incompetence is so rich and so complete that it's almost an art form how incompetent they are. They get everything wrong at every turn, and it's not an if but when they get figured out. One of the strange things about the film is the mystery of how Dick Long actually died is not really the central point of the film. We find that out about halfway through. The fun part for me was just watching the slow wheels of justice in a town that doesn't have a sheriff, like a head sheriff, that really seems to care about anything going on in the town. The case is almost accidentally solved by a newcomer, who I think is played by Sarah Baker, who I think is the standout of the film. And she has this really wonderful way of playing someone who just wants to make a good sort of first day impression on the job, but is also smart enough to ask questions the right way and appear to stumble onto the truth. And maybe she does actually just stumble onto it. What it reminded me of at a certain point, once we know the truth, but we're like the audience knows more than most everyone else in the film, is it reminded me of like an older Coen Brothers film like Blood Simple or Fargo, where like we're just sort of waiting for everyone else to catch up with us. But that's the fun of it, is just watching how the pieces fall into place in ways we're not expecting. The death itself is that might be the thing that turns a lot of people off to this. Because it's pretty out there. I don't even think we could give it away if we wanted to be honest, but, boy, do they get dark and boy, do they get strange. I loved it. I didn't know a lot of the actors in this. I knew a couple, but it was kind of fun and more believable having these sort of lesser known actors play these parts. I was drawn into it, but like I said, I don't remember sitting there laughing at it, but I definitely found it very amusing. It's less about like it's. I found it very tense toward the end as you're sort of seeing things fall apart for these two idiots. And if you can handle the way he dies and get through that, I don't know. I thought it was pretty good.
Okay. All right. So that's The Death of Dick Long, which is playing at the Arclight in Chicago. Okay. I really liked Swiss Army Man.
I was
a huge fan of that movie. Are there any fart jokes in this one?
I don't think so.
No? Okay.
Well, I don't know if there could be, to be honest.
Okay. Yeah. Things don't go that way. Let's just say that.
All right. You guys hang on, all right?
Yep.
Okay. All right. Eric and Steve are here, and they join me every week for the Monday morning movie reviews, and we will continue reviewing all the new movies right after we take this break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everyone. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline Studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, here till 5 a.m., as we are every weekday morning. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It's Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey time, and we got that going. And much more. We're also going to talk about the finalists for the Toy Hall of Fame have been announced, and we're going to talk about that and more. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Stay connected on our Facebook page, too. It's facebook.com/Nick D Show. Every Monday morning, we do the Monday morning movie reviews. Eric Childress and Steve Procopi join me, and let's bring the guys back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
All right, Steve, tell us about Abominable.
Sure. You know, with especially with animated works, there are times when I might be tempted to give points to a film with a strong sort of visual sense, even if it's the story's a bit lacking. But and while the new DreamWorks animation movie Abominable certainly has a flair for color and light, and most of that's just because the film's set in China, which has these beautiful cities and these sort of mountainous landscapes and are recreated very nicely here, the rest of the film is sort of so emotionally vapid and predictable and unoriginal that I had a tough time caring about anything I was seeing. This is a story about two worlds colliding, and it opens with some sort of wild creature escaping from a scientific research facility and ending up on the roof of this apartment building where this teenager named Yi, who's voiced by Chloe Bennett, lives with her mother and grandmother, both of whom are concerned about her being out all the time and not spending enough time with the family. It turns out that Yi is secretly working a series of odd jobs to make money for a trip she wants to take, and she is feeling distance from her family after her father died a year earlier. Even when she's home, she spends a lot of time on the roof of this building where she runs into this creature that turns out to be a Yeti. And when she finally figures out what he is, she names him Everett after the place he comes from and where she wants to return him to. The giant-sized creature is also on the run from these scientists for the whole movie. They were holding him, and the head of this facility was a doctor named Dr. Zara, who's voiced by Sarah Paulson. And the team's wealthy financier is an elderly British guy named Burnish, who's voiced by Eddie Izzard. And I will say, I was so happy he was, I did not know he was doing a voice in this. I was happy because at least he's allowed to riff a little, so the film does get a few glimpses of actual humor, as opposed to the more childish stuff going on most of the time. I guess this guy Burnish had a run-in with a Yeti when he was much younger, but he talked about it to the scientific community, but he didn't have any proof, so he was basically run out of town by them. So Yi decides to spearhead a journey to get Everest back home, and she takes her two closest friends and neighbors with her. Basically, it's just about taking E.T. home. That's basically what this is. And they sort of discover along the way that Everest has special, perhaps even magical, connections to nature that aids them in their journey and escaping. Yi's sort of struggles getting through the pain of losing her father, and that's about the most interesting thing about her, which at least gave me someone to root for during this. But honestly, I got to say, I didn't really care about the fates of any of these characters. There is some visual innovation here. Most of it's reserved for Everest. And I kind of sort of eagerly found myself waiting for his next magic trick without paying that much attention to what was going on in between. I like the way the film uses violin music, because it's not only as a score, but also Yi used to play violin. She was encouraged by her father to do so, and she sort of picks it up again on this trip as she is going through this healing process. But too much of the film is sort of formulaic, borrowing ideas from other films that might not have been worth borrowing in the first place. There's a sequence involving exploding blueberries, that these giant exploding blueberries, that seems very juvenile in poignment and only serves to make us think of another movie involving a famous candy connoisseur. There's nothing offensively wrong with Abominable. It's just trying so hard to be unique. It's safe to a fault. It seems disinterested in its own outcome, and which is too bad because, like I said before, the setting and some of the subject matter could have really been something special, but this is definitely not.
I liked it more than you did. I didn't think it was great by any stretch of the imagination. Certainly not the most original thing in the world, but I thought it was really nicely animated. It's really a lot of fun to watch. I liked the character. I thought Everest was fun and interesting. I wasn't crazy about her sidekicks, but I thought the main character was really interesting, and I did sort of feel for her plight, the whole loss of her father, mm-hmm. and that got me. And I thought, you know, like Eddie Izzard clearly is having a lot of fun. So is Sarah Paulson. Generic villains, you know. I mean, and you're right. It's E.T. That's all it is. It's like. I mean, you know, I don't know how many times, you know, people are going to basically take E.T.'s story and just do it over and over and over and over and over again. But this is, again, another example of that. Mm-hmm. But I will say that I was never not entertained throughout the movie, and there were several sequences that I thought were just like really beautifully done. I do have questions. I know maybe I shouldn't even question this, but I was like, if this suddenly about halfway through the movie, we discover that this Yeti has these magical powers, why didn't he use them before? You know, there's very select, you know what I'm saying, Steve? There's like very, there's very selective moments in the movie where suddenly it's very convenient for him to have like these, these magical powers that we didn't know he had till about 45 minutes or an hour into the film. And then every time he used them, I'm like, why didn't he use those? Why didn't he use those before? You know, like I said, the character I thought was, I found the character to be kind of charming, and it made me laugh a little bit. But yeah, her sidekicks are annoying. Those two, the two guys, especially the kid, the little kid.
I barely mentioned them because I didn't want to get into it.
No, the basketball kid made me nuts. But I really liked her, and I thought it was nice to have a sort of at the core of this this movie, a strong, you know, young female character to carry the whole thing. I thought that was nice. But again, there's nothing original here, and if you skipped it, you can skip it. But I liked it more than you did. I was entertained by most of it, so that's abominable. All right, there you go. And that's out right now and actually made some money over the weekend. We'll talk about that, too. Okay, let's get back to it. Eric, tell us about The Day Shall Come.
Okay, well, this is the latest film from Chris Morris, who last time had a theatrical release was this really great movie called Four Lions that I recommend people look up and see as soon as possible. But this is the first film. That was 9 years ago, so it's been a long time waiting for a follow-up to that film. And he's kind of on very familiar turf, in a way. This story is about what happens when the FBI are basically running low on cases and are trying to sort of justify their ways and means of handling terrorism in this country, and the way that they're able to sometimes manipulate things in a way to, you know, get people who are kind of, you know, half-cocked, crazy, or on the outskirts of the law, and basically, you know, just kind of build them up a little bit more, sort of manipulate them into creating bigger crimes, and then, you know, arresting them on the spot, and then being able to just sort of justify their numbers. Anna Kendrick plays one of these FBI agents who comes across a story of this kind of low-level, you know, Miami preacher who played by named Marshawn Davis, who, you know, is just kind of a preacher. He's got a big mouth. He has a little bit of a commune. He has a family, trying to, you know, provide from them. But he talks a big game about revolution and taking over the country and things like that. And when they sort of get wind of him, they decide, well, let's sort of manipulate this guy into a much larger arms deal for his big revolution. And then when we catch him red-handed, we can arrest him and, you know, we're the good guys again. We're sort of dealing with government and sort of real life exploitation of terrorism, sort of the same way that he utilized in Four Lions. Four Lions really, you know, walked a very thin tightrope and walked it quite beautifully, I thought. Dealing with jihadists who, you know, like the death of DeLong, happen to be, you know, really incompetent.
Okay, hang on, Eric.
And watching them having to go through what they.
Hang on, Eric.
Okay,
we got to take a break. Hold on a second. That's Eric and Steve. We're going to take a break. We'll come back, and we will talk more about The Day Shall Come right after this on WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive. Monday morning, that means my dad's going to call and tell a joke, and we're in the middle of the Monday morning movie reviews. All right, let's welcome Eric and Steve back to the show. Right before the break, Eric was telling us about a film called The Day Shall Come. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
Okay, go ahead, Eric. Continue.
Yeah, so what I was saying about Four Lines is how it kind of walked this really thin tightrope of, you know, dealing with these real-world issues of terrorism and how the idiocy of jihadism, walked this weird parallel line. And Four Lines was at times screamingly funny. Chris Morris, you know, in between theatrical features, has directed several episodes of Veep, and his co-writing partner on both Four Lines and The Day Shall Come is Jesse Armstrong, who is also part of the team that created the Thick of It, wrote episodes of, and also co-wrote the screenplay for In the Loop. Watching Day Shall Come, it's kind of interesting to see how that influence of those, you know, previous projects, and including Veep, which is very fresh in people's memory, is really, they're really trying to get that dynamic.
Eric, let me ask you this. Do you watch Succession?
Yes.
Do you watch Succession?
Not yet.
Okay, you should.
I know. I have to get through it.
Okay. I just wanted to mention, because he created it. So,
Chris Morris? Or
no, Chris, Jesse Armstrong did.
Jesse Armstrong, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And so you can see that, you know, throughout this movie, there's several, there's a much larger ensemble that I didn't even get to. Dennis O'Hare plays the lead FBI agent, who's also very good in this movie. And especially, particularly in the FBI scenes, where there's a lot of insulting going on, and everyone's trying to one-up the other, and everyone's trying to put down Anna Kendrick for various reasons, but she's generally the smartest person in the room because she's Anna Kendrick. And you see the way that they're trying to sort of, really kind of capture that rhythm. And there's one particular actor amongst the FBI group who is so bad at his delivery and everything that he does, that every time he steps into the conversation, it completely throws off the rhythm of those scenes. But thankfully, you have people like Kendrick and O'Hare to sort of bring it back up to a certain level. And I thought that there's funny stuff going on with the lead character, the revolutionary, who some people have kind of been bothered about the fact that he may have actually a mental illness. But I think that also kind of adds to, what Chris Morris and Armstrong are trying to, sort of reveal with the story, in the way that, look at the way people are trying to exploit mental illness these days as far as to form their own political ends. If we're dealing with exploitation of mental illness, I'll take this movie over a movie that's opening next week any day of the year. But at the same time, it's that the movie is kind of uneven in that way. And while I laughed quite a bit throughout the movie, I couldn't shake, after I saw this at South by Southwest this year, that just how uneven the movie is in its tone with its politics and the storytelling. Although there is really funny stuff in this movie. The Jim Gaffigan shows up because now that's the law. And he's very funny in it. It's one of the movies that I'm kind of giving kind of a partial recommendation to, because I think it is kind of good enough, and I like what he's trying to accomplish with this movie, even though it's not nearly as successful as Four Lions was. But I'm giving it just kind of a pass because Kendrick's really good, O'Hare's really good, the lead guy I think is good, and like Steve said earlier, I kind of admired what he's going for more than I entirely bought the entire concept.
Okay. All right. Steve, what'd you think?
I thought this was screamingly funny. I mean, and there were times when I wasn't sure if I was supposed to be laughing or crying a couple times, because that is the beauty. And he did the same thing with Four Lions, is you're like, is this supposed to be funny or is this supposed to be like realistic, because there are definitely moments in this film where you're really not sure. I mean, the way that the agents are portrayed, the FBI agents are portrayed, some of them are just flat out racist and misogynistic, and all in a very sort of casual, matter of fact way that sort of implies that we're not even supposed to question whether that's true or not. It just is. And that character you were talking about, Eric, that guy, he's there to derail everything. Like that was just, oh my God, that guy was so obnoxious that I couldn't get enough of him. Like Anna Kendrick, I don't think she's been this funny ever, or at least in a really long time. She's just like rattling off the insults like she is auditioning for Veep. It's so great. And like I said, the rest of the dialogue kind of flies fast, and the plot is confusing, but I think that's part of the joke, that no one really understands everything that's going on. The plan doesn't make sense. At one point, Moses, the lead, the potential terrorist, offers to turn himself in, trying to collect a reward on himself, which is so funny. It's like ridiculous. I really loved actually an actress named Danielle Brooks who plays his wife. She's like the only person in this story that seems to have a clear sense of reality on either side of this equation. So I really liked her. And Dennis O'Hare is just so confident and so funny in this. The film is so smart. It's a little dangerous. It's kind of wicked. There's a great monologue. I think it's O'Hare that has it about arresting brown people versus black people. That is like, that's what I mean. Like, that's funny, except it's also probably true. Yeah. And it just like, not let alone like how to deal with these white supremacists that show up later. So, it's a little disjointed maybe, but I almost think that's deliberate, because this situation is disjointed, and it almost in a weird way verifies fears that you have about FBI and Homeland Security and ATF, like care more about arrests and convictions than actually solving crimes or preventing crimes, that it's about numbers more than safety. And I think this movie, I mean, it sometimes takes an outsider to show us what we're like on the inside. And I think that might be what Christopher Morris and Armstrong too have a real gift for.
Yeah, I think it's terrific, man. I laughed consistently through the whole thing. I watched it on VOD, and that's where you can mostly see it. It's on Prime Video, and it's also on demand. And I highly recommend it. I just love the style of this writing. Steve, are you watching Succession?
No.
Okay. You should, because it's great. And it has that sort of rapid fire style to it that I think is so funny and so great. I loved Four Lions and all that stuff, In the Loop and Veep and all that kind of, you know, this really sort of brutal dialogue that's delivered really quickly. I love that kind of style. And there's also a real sense of politics in this movie. And this newcomer who played Moses is great.
Yeah.
He's just terrific. Marchant Davis is great in it. And all the stuff with the FBI is really, really funny. And man, Kendrick is great in this. I mean, that kind of goes without saying at this point. Because if Anna Kendrick's in something, she's going to be good because she's Anna Kendrick. But you clearly see her having a great time spitting out this dialogue that she gets to say. I didn't have any issues with it being disjointed or anything like that. I was on board for the entire ride. I just really love this sort of smart aleck style that these guys go for, and in terms of the writing, it's really short too. I mean, it's less than an hour and a half. So it came and went really quickly, and I actually wanted more when it was over. I think this is really strong stuff. Both in terms of what it's trying to say politically and socially, and also just the number of laughs in it. There are a lot of laughs in this movie. It is a very, 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 very funny movie. So that's The Day Shall Come. It is available on VOD, and I, for one, highly, highly recommend it. I thought it was hysterical. So, all right, that's The Day Shall Come. All right, you guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to take
mm-hmm.
a break. When we come back, we got one more movie to review, and then we'll talk about the box office as well. Eric Childress, Steve Procopi join me every Monday morning for the Monday Morning Movie Reviews, and we've got one more movie to talk about. It's a big one. It's the biopic about Judy Garland with Renee Zellweger, and we'll talk about Judy after we take a break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How's it going? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. Every weekday morning. I'm your overnight dude from 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. And it is Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We're going to talk about the Toy Hall of Fame. They're announcing their finalists. And we're going to talk to your favorite toys and all kinds of fun stuff. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Stay connected on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. Monday morning movie reviews continue. Steve Procopi, Eric Childress join me every Monday to review the new movies. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
All right. Steve, tell us about Judy.
Yes. I think the most important thing to know about Judy, which is a look at sort of later period of Judy Garland's life, starring Renee Zellweger as the troubled but exceedingly talented superstar, is that it's not meant to be a conventional biopic. While we do get the occasional flashback to Garland's very rough and demeaning time on the set of Wizard of Oz and just with MGM in general, the movie is actually more about how a lifetime of insecurities, especially about her weight and her looks, that were drilled into her from a young age by studio heads and her mother and other handlers, sort of took its toll on Garland. She was also troubled by substance abuse and a desire to be loved unconditionally, especially by men, which led to a lot of troubled entanglements and five husbands. But instead of basing Judy on a biography, the director Rupert Gould, who did a film a few years ago called True Story, is working from a stage play called End of the Rainbow by Peter Quilter. And I'm fairly certain the resulting film is meant to be more of an interpretive musical of Garland's final series of sold-out concerts in London in the winter of 1968. She died the next year, middle of the next year. And it's not a traditional movie musical, but the film does feature a great number of singing numbers, all performed by Zellweger, that show the variety of both Garland's singing abilities and her capacity to entrance and get lost on stage and turn in a solid show, but then also sometimes turn that show into a train wreck and leaving her devoted audience and the show's producers very disappointed. It's not, at the time, Garland didn't really have a choice about whether to play these shows. We see in the beginning, she's essentially homeless, and with no money in her pocket and nowhere to settle in with her two kids, she has to give the kids back to their father, Sidney Luft, who's played by Rufus Sewell, and he immediately starts talking about changing the custody arrangement, so she has to go on this to do these shows in London to make money. Before she takes off, she goes to visit her older daughter Liza, and who introduces her to this sort of young, handsome, would-be entrepreneur named Mickey Deans, who's played by Finn Wittrock. The two start a courtship that eventually continues when he meets her in London a few weeks later. Eventually, he becomes the fifth husband. But in London, Garland is assigned an assistant who named Rosalind Wilder, who's played by the great Jesse Buckley, who was just in Wild Rose recently. And in many ways, once the film gets to London, Judy becomes almost as much her story as it does Garland's story. In fact, the story might have been a little more interesting if been told through the perspective of this outsider to Garland's life. But the two become quite close, and Wilder manages to keep enough professional distance to do her job and make sure Garland makes it to every show, almost every show, and she can't really control what happens on stage. But I got to say, watching every aspect of Zellweger's performance was entrancing and sometimes painful, just because of who she's playing. She captures the essence of what Garland was going through on her best and worst days, the agony of being away from her children, the joy when she was in perfect sync with her band and her audience, the inevitable meltdowns that occurred when these sort of traumatic memories of her youth come creeping back. An actress named Darcy Shaw plays the younger Garland in these flashbacks, and she's really asked to endure what amounts to bullying by MGM lackeys and even Louis B. Mayer himself, in an effort to keep her thin and pretty to play Dorothy. Again, I have no idea if these moments are accurate, but they feel authentic, and they probably happen to many young starlets in the 40s and 30s. I don't think for a second those scenes don't have a very contemporary resonance as well. Judy also captures its subject's capacity for optimism and keeping her dreams alive, both for a comeback and for love, or to come back into her life. I'm sure some will view her as delusional, and that maybe is partly true, but that doesn't stop us from rooting for her. But most of the reason the film is in any way a success is because of Zellweger, and even if ultimately the film doesn't impress you, I think her kinetic performance is damn near perfection. So a recommendation, if not a strong recommendation.
Okay. Eric, what'd you think?
Not a recommendation for me. We sometimes talk about movies that sometimes take on the personality of their lead actor or the main character that they're doing, or vice versa. And to me, it seemed like, you know, this is a movie that was also, you know, pretty pilled up as well, because I don't think this movie has a really solid focus on what story they wanted to really tell with Judy Garland, you know, with the exception of, you know, the way the one Steve described, and basically giving us the third act, for the most part, of Judy's life, that I don't think this movie really grasped exactly, you know, what was so great about Judy Garland. I don't think this movie has a really strong point of view about, you know, who this woman was, and really wrapped its arms around what I think is probably one of the greatest tragedies in Hollywood history, as far as talent and you know, how young she was when she died. And you know, the scenes to me, the best scenes in the movie are the scenes of her in youth. Before we even, you know, we get to Renee Zellweger, I think that opening scene with Louis B. Mayer is a stunner. Not, you know, if people, you know a little bit about Garland's history, you know, this is, you know, a story about child abuse, basically. And I think that there's a much stronger case to be made about really digging into that aspect of it and maybe splitting the time between the childhood stuff, and then you know what eventually happened to her during the last year of her life. You know, Renee Zellweger is giving her all to this performance. There's, you know, it is, sometimes it feels like impersonation, but there are other times where when she's not doing the stage stuff and she's just kind of reacting to certain things, you know, she's really grabbing those Judy Garland mannerisms. But you can see, you know, her trying to, you know, mask the pain through humor or other things. So I think there's a lot of stuff to admire about Zellweger's performance. But, you know, we've seen a lot of movies where, you know, really great performances in movies that are able to sort of absorb the flaws of the rest of the film. And I think this movie's flaws are there to sort of absorb Renee Zellweger's performance, which is kind of an irony, given that that's exactly what Hollywood did to Judy Garland herself. You know, like this, all the stuff with Finn Wittrock, who seems to have based his entire performance on Tom Hulce in Parenthood. Just none of that stuff. I didn't want to see, you know, sit there with any more of that. I really want to see more of the relationship with their children. I thought, yeah, that would have been a much more interesting thing, given, you know, what she had gone through as a child. I think Jesse Buckley is completely wasted in this movie. That was really troublesome to me. It was nice to see that Renee Zellweger does her own singing in the film. I wasn't quite sure when I first started hearing if that was her or not. But, you know, I mean, you know, this movie, you know, it's certainly better than, much better than Bohemian Rhapsody, just for the sake that it's not Bohemian Rhapsody. But I think this movie has some of those same flaws, too, in that understanding the genius of this character. And, you know, when Louis B. Mayer is describing to her, you know, how great she actually is, but, you know, by essentially belittling her at the same time, you know, I think this, you know, it kind of, you know, rubs off on us, too. And I don't think we really get a great sense of just how great this talent was. And I thought it was pretty embarrassing the way they sort of worked in this homosexual couple in the middle of the film, and then used them to basically get this, be a part of this climax that which I read up on, according to Liza Minnelli, actually happened in a way. It's not quite like that, but Liza said she actually was there and kind of instigated a little bit. But, you know, I don't know if all that checks out or not, but. And then it just kind of ends, and it's just like you don't even like get the full satisfaction of like this kind of this last moment of triumph before she, you know, ends up losing her life. I, you know, as much as I like Zellweger and I like watching her, I wish this movie had a greater focus and a greater grasp on who Judy Garland really was.
Okay, all right, guys, hang on. Eric Childress and Steve Procopio are here. We'll come back. I'll tell you what I thought of Judy after this on 720 WGN.
Of light in the skies over Hollywood.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And it is a Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's what he does every Monday morning. We're going to be talking about the Toy Hall of Fame and its current finalists and much more. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can also follow us on Twitter and at Nick D Show, and Facebook at facebook.com/Nick D Show. Monday morning movie reviews are wrapping up here. Eric Childress and Steve Procopi. Eric, welcome back. Steve,
thank
welcome
you.
Back. And,
hello.
All right, we're talking about Judy, which is the film about Judy Garland. I really liked it. I really liked it. I really liked the idea that it's just set in that small period of time in London. I thought it was a unique way to tell this to tell the story at that particular time in her career, just to have that be, you know, like during the holidays in 1968, and that's pretty much the whole focus of the movie, you know, in addition to, you know, the flashbacks to when she was young. I think Renee Zellweger is unbelievable in this movie. I've always liked Renee Zellweger, but she blew me away in this movie. I think she's unbelievable. I think it's not only a great performance, but the musical stuff that she does in it is extraordinary. I think this is easily one of the best performances of the year, without question, and she needs to be nominated for Best Actress for it. It is a great performance, a great performance. And I felt for her. I was, you know, and I think the movie, I don't think the movie just comes to an end. I think there's a crescendo of feeling at the end of this film. There were people bawling in the theater. By the way, the median age when we went to go see this movie at the theater was about 80. My dad even commented, my dad's 78, you know, my dad even commented, my dad goes, man, there were a lot of people with walkers in the theater, and it was a very older crowd. I mean, it's a movie about Judy Garland, so you would obviously expect that. But they came out in droves; the place was packed on a Saturday afternoon. And you know, I didn't even. By the way, I didn't even recognize Rufus Sewell at all. Like, I didn't
really?
Even know. I swear to you, I didn't even know it was him. Like, I didn't know until the credits. I was like, what? I didn't as her ex husband. I don't know. I thought Jesse Buckley was
like this,
Go ahead.
That was like the role. I'd be surprised if Rufus Sewell didn't play that role.
Yeah, no, I thought he was good. I thought he was very good in it. In fact, I thought Jessie Buckley was great. I thought she, I thought their relationship was really fun and really interesting and kind of the core of the movie. And you know, I was on board with pretty much all of it. I was emotionally invested in it, really. And I thought the scene where they go back to the apartment with the gay couple was really sweet and you know, really, 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 really nice. And it kind of, you got to know both of those guys, and you got even more, you know, in depth in what Judy Garland was doing. And I loved the scene where she goes out to see them outside of the theater and suggests that they go get something to eat. I love the reaction that the two guys had, you know, when they're trying to find some restaurant that's open and then they're making bad omelets. All of that stuff worked for me. I don't know. It just did. I think one of the reasons why I was so invested, I think the main reason why I was so invested in this story is because of Zellweger. I can't say enough about her performance. It is a great, great performance, and she really captures Judy Garland. It's not imitation to me. It wasn't like watching Rami Malek. This was like to me there was a total investment in her emotion, physically, you know, and vocally. The musical numbers are wonderful to watch, and there's particularly hard, really amazing sequence that's done in almost one take, one full take, where it's just Renee Zellweger performing, and the energy that she's giving out is incredible. So you know, it's a biopic. You know, you've seen it before. I did think the structure was kind of interesting, that they just took that small period of time late in her life, the last big shows that she did in London. I thought that was an interesting way to do it. And I thought it all worked. I really did. I think it's a really good film, and at the center of it is a really, really extraordinary performance by Renee Zellweger. So I'm recommending it. So, all right. Next week we've got Joker, correct?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And then Lucy in the Sky, right? The space movie with Natalie Portman.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
Did you see that, Eric? Did that play at Toronto?
No. It did play Toronto, but that was the night I was leaving Toronto, and then my flight got canceled. So,
got it.
I didn't get to see that one.
Okay, all well, right. We'll talk about that next week. Steve, thanks, man.
Thanks.
Okay, buddy, we'll talk to you next week. All right, Eric, let's jump into some box office.
Yeah.
Abominable made $20.8 million, which is not great, right?
It's not great. It's not disastrous. It's just kind of there.
Yeah.
I think they were happy to get over the 20 million threshold. We're like 1 year removed from Smallfoot.
Yeah.
In many ways, it's the same kind of movie.
Yeah.
And that one, had like a $23 million opening and ended up grossing $83 million. I think you could probably find this one end up, you know, somewhere in the 60s. But you know, this also cost $75 million to make. So they're really going to be, you know, thrusting on those international dollars to bring it home. Smallfoot didn't turn a profit either.
Okay. Downton Abbey, $14.5 million. Man, big solid hit for the adults who are going to the movies.
Yeah, speaking of 80-year-olds and walkers.
Yeah.
This is, I mean, they got a 1-2 punch this week. And, yeah, I mean, it was a pretty big drop. That's kind of what I was kind of expecting it to do. But you know what? It was a $58 million so far.
Yeah.
It's only like $25 million away from becoming Focus's all-time domestic grosser, beating Brokeback Mountain.
Wow!
And the path it's on right now, it really has legitimate shot to break $100 million. I think it might come up a bit short of that, considering the drops. This is a solid hit.
Yeah. Hustlers $11.4 million. That's up to $80 million. That's bigger than people thought, right?
This one, I mean, it had a drop last week, not so much this week. It really kind of leveled off, jumped back from fifth place up to third place, and this one is on a path to hit over $100 million now. So, yeah, this is a really solid hit for STX, who were, you know, and I don't think they're entirely out of the woods yet, but they were on the verge of being no more.
Yeah,
and you know they still have a couple movies in the pipeline that they're not going to do Hustlers money, but this, you know, this will at least get them the money to release those other movies.
Yeah,
so that's where they are right now.
Well, that's cool. Number four, It Chapter Two, $193.9 total. Is that underperforming for the first one?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think people are not as enthused about this one as they were the first one, and you know, while this is, it's going to, you know, pass $200 million sometime in the next week, The first one, grossed like $350 million or $330 million, something like that. So this one's going to do $100 million less than the first movie. But all being said, we're talking about, like $1.2, $1.3 billion between the two movies.
Right. Okay. Boy, Ad Astra. Wow. $10 million, only $35 million in 2 weeks.
Yeah. No, this one's kind of headed for like a mid-50s. Landing, and again, $80 million opening. It's grossed $89 million worldwide so far. I wouldn't call it necessarily a disaster by any stretch, but it's not going to make the Disney execs very happy, with what the direction that their Fox movies are doing right now.
All right. Rambo Last Blood, $8.5 million, $33 million total.
Yeah, a bigger drop than Ad Astra, and it's probably going to settle in probably in the mid-40s, probably, which will probably be a little bit more than what the last Rambo movie did. So inflation is kind of right on par with that.
Okay. And then seven coming in here is Judy with $3 million, almost $3.1 million. But it's only in a limited amount of theaters. Did it have a pretty good per-screen average or no?
Very well. Yeah, they did. Yeah. I mean, 461 theaters. It did just a little over $3 million.
Oh, that's good.
And since 2000... this is only the fifth movie in theaters in an opening between 400 and 500 theaters to gross $3 million or more. It's only the fifth time that's happened.
Well, the theater
was a very impressive start.
Like I said, Eric, theater was packed. It was packed.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And so, Roadside handles this right. I think that they have another kind of genuine little hit on their hand. And more clearly, they're going to be pushing Zellweger for actress.
No kidding. Yeah.
Exactly what they want.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. All right, Eric, obviously, we're going to have to deal with Joker next week, and we'll talk about that.
We're going to have to deal with that. Yeah. God bless you, Nick.
All right, Eric, take care.
Okay.
There you go. Eric Childress and Steve Procopi will join me again next week for the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. Let's take a break here on 720 WGN.